Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hi, everybody. And with the Susan Rice news you just heard, the Christie news, and so much going on, we are delighted to begin today with arguably the leading chronicler of the Obama administration, Jonathan Alter, NBC News analyst and Bloomberg View columnist. His new book about the turbulent last 2 years, including the president's reelection, is called The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. So we'll talk about the last 2 years, the last 2 days, the last 2 hours. Hi, Jonathan.
How are you, Brian?
Great to have you back.
Thanks.
And within the last 2 hours, the White House dropped word that the embattled Susan Rice will be named National Security Advisor. Interesting parry by Obama against his enemies after the Benghazi situation got her rejected for Secretary of State. What do you make of it?
Well, he's always been close to Susan Rice since she was his national security advisor during his first presidential campaign. And he talked to her every day about how he should position himself on foreign policy issues. He thought that the rap on her was ridiculous, that she was simply taking talking points that turned out to be wrong, but that came from the CIA. And so for her to be attacked this way for something that she took from nonpartisan CIA people, the director of national intelligence, the president was offended by. So, and it's important to note, though, Brian, that this position does not require Senate confirmation. So
I was just going to point that out, unlike Secretary of State.
Right.
So he's like, yeah, 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 to the Republicans in the Senate?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting childhood taunt, but that Washington has become like a playground. So I guess you could put it that way. But this president, I don't think he thinks of it as kind of in your face. It's more like this is a person I'm comfortable with. You could argue that he's too comfortable with some of the people around him and should have some bigger players who can give kind of dissenting opinions and are less satellites of him.
And that's one of the things in your book, that his advisors not only have Obama's back, they have his front, is I think the way you put it, meaning they stop him from interacting with people who are different from him.
I don't think they always stop him from interacting with them, but they stop those people from getting too close to him. He's a grown up, and it reminds me of something that the late David Halberstam said of President Kennedy, which is that he was his own Secretary of State and his own National Security Advisor. And I think we get so used to thinking of these presidents, particularly in the liberal imagination, Presidents Reagan and George W. Bush being kind of the puppets of their advisors, we maybe pay almost a little too much attention.
Yes.
To who he surrounds himself with. But I do think that he needs to open that circle more and get more used to having people who make him uncomfortable some of the time rather than cozy.
Well, certainly in the Obama case with respect to foreign policy, he is his own Secretary of State. He is his own National Security Advisor. He turned down Hillary Clinton's and Leon Panetta's suggestion, correct me if I'm wrong, that he start getting involved in Syria, helping to arm the rebels, that kind of thing, rejected that advice from the high levels of his own administration. Will Susan Rice help Obama not get involved in Syria or try to talk him into it?
Well, I would imagine that she's on the same page as he is on not intervening. There have been cases in the past, where Susan Rice and Samantha Power did push for intervention in Egypt and Libya, and they were very outspoken on that within the councils of government. To me, in some ways, the more
because I just want people to know why you brought up that other name.
Yeah.
Also announced today, Samantha Power would replace Rice as the UN ambassador. She would need Senate confirmation.
Right.
And Power, who I've met, is such a fascinating figure. She first became known as a very powerful human rights advocate for her books on the topic. But I remember when she was on this show, and I guess it was 2002, agonizing over whether to support the idea of an Iraq war. She was on the fence as kind of an interventionist-oriented internationalist who could see the argument for going in on the grounds of human rights of for the Iraqi people, though she may have eventually come down opposed.
See, this is where it's going to get really interesting, not just because she requires Senate confirmation and could become a punching bag for the Senate Republicans. She believes in humanitarian intervention. She's a human rights activist, and her book, Problem from Hell, is probably the best book ever written about genocide.
Unbelievable.
And so the question in my mind is, will she be able to go in front of the UN and defend an American policy that rejects intervention in Syria? And it's going to be fascinating to watch how that plays out.
I imagine that was part of the vetting process, testing her comfort level with
that. I imagine that it was. And it's going to be fascinating also to see what happens when she comes up against sort of foreign policy poobahs who don't think much of her, the breadth of her foreign policy background. They just see her as a human rights person who Obama liked because he liked her book originally when he was in the Senate, and they don't see her as a heavyweight in foreign policy, the old foreign policy establishment types. And we'll see whether they use that to try to block her in the Senate.
Jonathan Alter, his new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Before we get off Susan Rice and this reported selection to be the National Security Advisor, on Benghazi, and you were getting at this, I think the central claim of the president's enemies about Susan Rice's Sunday talk show appearances back then in September being a cover for the reelection campaign, that claim is kind of falling apart because those emails that were released showed the State Department trying to cover its rear, and I want to get your take on that, but nothing from the White House or the campaign about the election. So where do you think that actually stands on the facts?
Well, the Republicans since the campaign have been trying to turn it into Watergate, and if you looked at Fox's coverage in the latter days of the campaign, where I have an incident where, Geraldo Rivera tries to offer a dissenting view and they cut his mic, they were determined to beat the drum on this, and it turned out it was kind of a big nothing burger, to my mind. There's some other so-called scandals that really do concern me, AP and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But this just feels
there was an underpinning
totally trumped up.
There was an underpinning of common sense. If the president was running on bin Laden is dead and General Motors is alive, and then al-Qaeda stages a successful attack at a U.S. consulate on September 11th, no less, it risks blowing the narrative to some degree, right?
Totally, yeah. So I can understand where they thought that this happened. But, despite Daryl Issa's best efforts and that of many other people, they haven't really been able to come up so far with the evidence for it. And to me, what was really interesting about Benghazi in the campaign is I explain how actually Obama helped use Benghazi to help win the election for him, because they set a trap for Romney in that second debate. They went to the Hilton Hotel on Long Island near Hofstra, and Ben Rhodes from the White House walked Obama through a sequence of events, and he brought the transcript along with him from Obama's comments in the Rose Garden. And remember, Mitt Romney had been out there saying on the trail that Obama never called it an act of terror and never connected Benghazi to an act of terror. And they had a transcript showing that he had on the day after tragedy in Libya. So they set a trap, and then we all saw the way the president sprung that trap in the debate. And I argue that the debate and arguably
Candy Crowley
Candy Crowley
was an unwitting part of that
right.
trap, affirming as the moderator, which
right.
shocked everybody, that, yeah, the president did say
right.
that. I remember that.
She was
that.
Doing her job, going to the facts. But it ended the debate right there. And Obama's horrible performance in Denver had been redeemed by his performance
right.
in the second debate.
Right.
And
well,
you could argue that the election was effectively over at that moment.
Although if he conceded that it was an act of terror on the day after the attack, why was Susan Rice going out 5 days later on Face the Nation and everything and saying, no, we think it was a spontaneous outburst because of the anti-Muslim videos?
Well, I think that's a fair question. Remember, on September 12th, when he was in the Rose Garden, they were kind of throwing it in there as, you know, it was a vague connection to terror. But it wasn't really the moment for them to make a definitive connection to an al-Qaeda group or terrorist organization because they didn't have enough information yet. But that's not what Romney was alleging on the campaign. He got himself into trouble by alleging that they didn't use the word terror, didn't put it into any kind of a terrorism context. And that wasn't true.
One other thing about that before we get into some of the news that you make in your book about those State Department emails and the possible role yet to be determined of Hillary Clinton, because I think the Republicans, you talk about Obama and his enemies as the title of your book. Well, those enemies are going to try to start taking aim at Hillary Clinton, assuming
yep.
she's the Democratic frontrunner for 2016. And there, her role yet to be really fleshed out may be directing that word of the prior warnings of an attack in Benghazi be removed from the talking points. One of her underlings at State has that in there, so as not to make the State Department look bad. Does that now make them look bad and her look bad?
There are a lot of bureaucrats who don't look very good in this. They're doing the normal kind of CYA that happens a lot in government. But the reason that I call it a kind of a nothing burger scandal is that sort of thing goes on all the time in any kind of a large organization. Everybody's already scampering for cover. They're not covering themselves with glory in doing so. But you got to remember what the Republicans have been alleging in Benghazi, that, you know, they issued a stand down order, that somehow there was no concern about trying to protect the lives of the people in the region. The overreach is such that the American people, just as they did when Clinton was impeached in other cases, just as they did on the birther story or some of the nonsense that I recount in the section I call Obama derangement syndrome, by overreaching on this, they're not getting the American public on their side. It's not like anybody except their hardcore base, which was not enough to win the election, cares about Benghazi. They care about their own lives. And this is something the politicians just repeatedly fail to acknowledge. And because the Obama campaign got it better than Romney, and they understood that it was about the middle class and their daily struggles, that was the main reason they prevailed.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC will continue in a minute with Jonathan Alter, his new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. And we can take your phone calls for him on Obama and his enemies at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. No matter where on the political spectrum you are, give us a call. We'll continue with Jonathan Alter and get into some of the fascinating revelations in this book. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Jonathan Alter, NBC News analyst, Bloomberg View columnist, one of the leading chroniclers of the Obama years in the White House. His new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. And one of the fascinating things in your book is your deep dive into the world of the data geeks who did so much
right.
to help President Obama get reelected. You call them the cave dwellers. Who are the cave dwellers?
Well, during the campaign, there was a secret annex to the Chicago headquarters called the Cave, and it was a windowless room Nobody from outside the campaign was allowed there. Visitors like me could go to the main floor. The only outsider who ever got in there was Eric Schmidt, the head of Google. And these were where it was headed by a 28-year-old named Dan Wagner. They had this motley collection of data scientists, but also three professional poker players, a biophysicist, a child prodigy, and they designed these models that really helped to revolutionize American politics and to create great efficiencies in the construction and execution of the most sophisticated political campaign in American history, and also the largest with 2 million volunteers. So a lot of their model and all the tech stuff they did wouldn't have done any good if there weren't the forces on the ground. But the combination of the shoe leather and the technology and the fact that there was what I call a geek gap between Romney and Obama was very potent. And I wanted – everybody knows that Obama did better on the digital front. I wanted to explain how he did better and get into some of these fascinating – things that he did, and to translate them from people from the original geek so that they could understand it.
Yeah. So let's get into the weeds on a couple of these things. Our listeners are geek-friendly enough to handle it. There may even be a few actual geeks in the listening audience. We've done surveys, and I think we've demonstrated. But you write about something called the propensity model. That's one. And you have this amazing line that all the fundraisers of the world should definitely read from one of them, that ignoring the human desire not to be irritating may have been the single greatest conceptual breakthrough of the campaign. So let's take each of those. What was that about not being irritating and okay. the ability to ignore that to have a campaign breakthrough?
So that line comes from a guy named Teddy Goff, another 27-year-old who was head of digital. They had three tech divisions within the campaign, which were sometimes at war with each other, which is also part of the story. There was trouble in digital paradise for a while. But Teddy Goff headed digital. He had more than 200 people working for him, and they were able to take online fundraising, which was just one of many things that they did in that department, from raising $15 million a month a year ago in June of 2012 to raising $150 million a month by the fall, a tenfold increase. And they cracked the code. And one of the ways they did crack the code on internet fundraising was that they were willing to be annoying and obnoxious with those emails that many of your listeners saw in their mailbox.
Because they, emails to people's inboxes?
Yeah.
If they had had previous contact with the Obama campaign or the Democrats?
Any kind
of –
they had at the end 20 million emails in their system. So what would happen was that they studied and everything was tested, and they found that the unsubscribe rate from those people who were really annoyed was less than the money, extra money that they would raise from annoying people, and that the more emails they sent out, the more money came back, period. But they had to be the right kind of emails, and they tested them endlessly to make sure that they were. And then they created like quick donates so that you could do it from your mobile device. And that set off what was called drunk donating, where people would be worried that Obama might lose after, you know, the first debate or something else that happened in the campaign. And almost without thinking about it, they'd click that donate button. And, you know, he ended up raising over $1.1 billion, and average donation $66. Romney's average donation $1,000.
Yeah.
So it was a revolutionary campaign in that way, and I got fascinated by the way they did it.
So Google could adopt a new model: don't be evil, but do be irritating.
could in terms of internet fundraising, yes. And Google, by the way, has hired — Eric Schmidt is creating a new company and hired a number of these people to bring some of these techniques into the private sector. But there was a huge role reversal at the center of this campaign. So my chapter on the Romney campaign, one of them is called Boston Mad Men. They were running what Romney's guys described as a Mad Men campaign that might not have been out of the 60s but was out of the 80s. They had people who had worked on Ronald Reagan's famous reelection campaign in 1984 who were making their ads, and these ads did not cut through, and they rejected proposal to do a big data project like Obama had.
Even though Romney, coming out of Bain Capital, was supposed to be the numbers guy.
He described as a numbers guy. So
at the data on all these companies, deciding whether to buy them, how to revamp them, all that stuff.
Right. So it's Obama who runs a Bain campaign, and Romney runs a campaign based on a vague hope for change. You know, it's very strange.
But one footnote to that story: it's depressing to think how much money mattered, as you report. If they could only raise $15 million a month and not $70 million a month, they thought they would lose. Really?
Well, I don't think the president ever thought he was going to lose. And what you're talking about is a scene where Jim Messina, the campaign manager, comes into Teddy Goff's office late at night when they're only raising $15 million a month. And he said, if we don't get up to $70 million a month online, and that doesn't include their offline fundraising – we're going to get blown out in the fall. Remember, you know, Adelson gave $100 million, one guy.
Sheldon Adelson, Republican donor.
Right, to the Republicans. So they were worried a year ago exactly that they were not going to have the resources that they needed to be competitive in the fall if these, you know, 27-year-olds couldn't deliver.
Jonathan Alter, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. His book, and you're right that Bill Clinton, despite his brilliant convention performance as the Secretary of Explaining Stuff, thought Obama was going to lose until Hurricane Sandy.
Well, that's what he told Mitt Romney when he called him the week after the election. So do we know that Clinton actually believed that? No, but he clearly was worried, as were a lot of people. And it's very easy now. A lot of people say, well, everybody knew Obama, you know, was going to win. I got a very favorable review in the Los Angeles Times the other day, but I took issue with the reviewer said, well, this wasn't suspenseful. You know, everybody knew Obama was going to win. Well, think back to last fall. I'm not sure that's really true. There were a lot of very smart people who thought that Obama was going to lose.
And obviously, had somebody, Karl Rove thought Obama was going to lose.
George,
he couldn't believe it on election night when Fox News called it for Obama.
And Romney didn't even write a concession speech. That's how sure they were. I've got a lot of fun details about how certain they were that they were going to win. And even people like George Will are saying he's going to get more than 300 electoral votes. It's going to be a blowout for Romney. And the way they just completely blew their polling and misunderstood what was going on in the country was fascinating. By that point, Obama was quite sure that he was going to win. And, you know, the Romney people released that they had 79,000 doors that had been knocked down in Ohio on the last weekend. And Obama was comforted when he was told that they had knocked down 375,000 doors that weekend. And he said, that's my team. So he went into the election very confident.
It is incredible that after the historic election of 2008, including the incredible surge of enthusiasm among black voters and Hispanic voters and college-age voters, followed by the enthusiasm gap for Obama among his base in all of those categories for almost the entire first term, that you can report that minorities voted for the president's reelection in even larger numbers than they voted in 2008.
That's right. And with the erosion in white support, especially white male support, they needed that. And, you know, I said a moment ago the president went in confident, and he did. But on election night, when NBC News called it for him at 11:12 p.m., Valerie Jarrett turns to him and says, "You won." And he says, "I'll believe it when I hear it on Fox." They really, you know, thought that it might be challenged in a lot of ways. Why did minorities turn out in much greater numbers? So I got fascinated by this question. And part of it was that there was a backlash to what I call the voter suppression project. In 19 states, Republicans got bills through that would have made it very, very difficult for Obama to be reelected if they'd stayed on the books. And a lot of them were overturned by judges or by other means. And so the Republicans got the worst of both worlds. The laws that were supposed to essentially rig the election for them were overturned, and the backlash against that was so overpowering that, as Al Sharpton said, African Americans vote for two reasons, out of hope or anger. They voted out of hope in 2008 and out of anger in 2012. And in terms of the Latinos, and this is critical because the only reason we're going to get immigration reform is because of Obama's margins with Latinos, there was a subterranean campaign that the Anglo media and the Anglo world in general really didn't know anything about where, you know, I ask people and I go around and ask people, maybe you know her. Do you know who the Latina Oprah is?
No.
Cristina Saralegui, critical to Obama's victory with Latino voters. They signed her up. She did these ads with Michelle Obama that ran on Univision and, you know, which ratings there dwarf anything on cable TV. There was a whole other campaign that went on in that world that paid huge dividends and where Romney also couldn't compete.
In its own Democratic constituency way, this reminds me a little of Bush's reelection, because despite the anti-Iraq war fervor that motivated Democrats massively to vote for Kerry, just like there was all this Obama hatred that motivated Republicans to turn out, Bush turned out even more of his Christian conservative base to vote for him in 2004 than he did in his first election in 2000. You see parallels?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I was talking to David Axelrod, Obama's chief strategist, and Stuart Stevens, Romney's chief strategist, for the last 2 years constantly. And in 2011, early 2011, Axelrod is already saying, we see this as 2004 where we're Bush. And meanwhile, Stuart Stevens saw it as 1980 where there was this massive revulsion against Jimmy Carter at the end and Ronald Reagan was swept into office. It turned out to be a lot more like 2004.
The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies, the new book by Jonathan Alter. Before you go, when you talk about Obama and his enemies and people digging in, the president is still stuck in gridlock on the big issue of the last 2 years, the time period that your book covers, the long-term debt and the elusive grand bargain. Will they just continue to muddle through on that for the next 3.5 years and not really fix what even most Democrats acknowledge is a long-term fiscal threat from a debt bomb from senior entitlements?
I think the impulse to kick the can down the road is so strong in Washington that muddle through is usually what happens. The pressure is a little off now. If the economy continues to grow, you know, the estimates on the deficit just went down $200 billion in the last couple of months. So they will do some things.
And Medicare price spikes are starting to level out.
Right.
There are some early indications of that. Paul Krugman in his column the other day said, look, folks, this is an indication that Obamacare, which is supposed to bend the cost curve, it's the Affordable Care Act, may actually be working, even though everybody says it's not going to work. I have no idea.
We'll see. But what's interesting to me—
But it's about health care costs.
Very critically important. They will do some things together. They won't have this kind of grand bargain. But I was trying to put this whole election in historical context. There's a lot of history in here, like, for instance, that the 47% was an issue between Nixon and McGovern, and Nixon made an ad on the 47%. And so when you're trying to look at it on like a historical continuum, Obama's presidency is going to be judged by how the economy does. And it seems to be getting better right now. So imagine if Romney had won. And this is why I think this was such a hinge of history and the most pivotal election of the nine that I've covered. If Romney had won, we would be in a situation much like in 1981 where Barack Obama would be seen as Jimmy Carter. He couldn't fix the economy. And once Romney's elected, you know, suddenly the economy gets better. So because you get somebody who's friendlier to business, who slashed taxes for the wealthy, slashed regulation, slashed programs for the poor, that the cause and effect would have been seen as, well, this is how we got this good economy. For a generation, progressives would have been discredited on the economy, which would have been devastating to Democrats for many, many years to come.
Yeah.
So it was all on the line in this election. And this is why I got so interested in it. And the president, by the way, aside from his normal competitiveness, he also believed this, that it wasn't just his achievements, but the entire New Deal, basically, the social contract was on the line. And Paul Ryan said the same thing. If we win, we will have a new social contract.
And the economy is getting better anyway because that's the cycle. Almost regardless of the policies on one side or the other?
Well, or because of the Fed. There's a lot of different reasons for that. But the way politics works, if it's on your watch, you get credit for it.
Jonathan Alter from NBC, MSNBC, Bloomberg View, his new book, The Center Holds Obama and His Enemies. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian.
And folks, if data geeks can use the web in the most sophisticated of ways, as we've been hearing, other people use it in ways most base. And we will talk next with Abraham Foxman from the Anti-Defamation League about hate speech on the internet and what to do about it. Stay with us.